following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
It is, and it's a Wednesday. Ugh. The middle of the week, which means we still have as much to go as we've already been through. I'm in a mood today. Let me tell you that. I am in a mood. In fact, cynical is back. Yeah, my inner cynic has appeared in a big way. So, for instance, if you follow me on Twitter, you'll notice that my handle is cynical now, with just a C-Y added at the beginning because... hey, cynical is me. All right, I'm supposed to have a guest here, and I don't see her here yet. But let me explain to you what this is about. And I've mixed feelings about airing this dirty laundry, as it were. But you know, I think sort of we have no choice. Our politics in this country are foobar, right? They're completely messed up. Let me back up. You may recall last year, it was actually more like a year and a half ago, I told you I was going to get involved in the Florida Broward County Democratic Party. And I am not a party person. I've always been a Democrat when I've been registered with a particular party, because I'm certainly not a Republican. When I lived in California, I had no party affiliation because I didn't feel the need to be in a party. The Democrats were always going to win. The Republicans, you know, especially where I lived, had no chance of doing much. So, but here in Florida, I have no choice. I really have to be registered as a Democrat. And then I got wind of a plan. The progressives, in a loosely knit coalition, many of them had been Bernie Sanders supporters, decided to try to do like a progressive, if not takeover, certainly influx of progressive Floridians into the Florida Democratic Party to give us a voice. Well, it wasn't only in Florida that this was going on. This was going on around the country. And in Nevada, the progressives won. Yes, they had a slate, much the same way we did here in Florida, of progressive candidates. And enough of them were involved that they were able to pull off a progressive takeover of the Nevada Democratic Party. So this woman named Judith, Judith, who's supposed to be joining me any minute now, Judith Whitmer, and I believe she's here now. She's just getting into the Zoom room. So she became chair of the Nevada State Democratic Party. So let me share with you, before I bring Judith on, a press release that just went out, because Judith was installed as chair of the Nevada State Democratic Party. But the Nevada State Democratic Party, you know, used to be run by Harry Reid. Talk about the insider's insider, or the establishment's establishment, right? So let me just share with you this press release that went out yesterday to the media. It says, "We are a group of loyal and concerned Democrats across the United States. It has come to our attention that the Democratic National Committee and its national campaign committees are working around and outside of the Nevada State Democratic Party by recognizing Nevada Democratic Victory, NDV, an organization not affiliated with the state party, as the coordinated campaign. Further, we've learned that resources normally given to the state party have been diverted to NDV based on false statements made to the Federal Election Commission with the assistance of a county party that has ties to the previous state party administration. We strongly denounce these actions and the deliberate attempts to delegitimize the state central committee election results by refusing to acknowledge the duly elected leadership of the Nevada State Democratic Party. With the upcoming critical midterm elections, it's unconscionable that a county party in collusion with an outside organization is willing to gamble Nevada's future. It's hypocritical that the DNC is arbitrarily treating the duly elected Nevada State Democratic Party differently than other state party organizations by funding and supporting a separate special interest PAC leading up to the 2022 midterm elections. They are violating the democratic process and principles of fairness and equity that we hold dear. We believe that these actions will be harmful to all Democratic candidates in 2022. We call upon the DNC chair, Jamie Harrison, to resolve this situation without undue delay by immediately recognizing the authority and leadership of the Nevada State Democratic Party with full return of all DNC and National Campaign Committee's support and resources. And the hashtag is, Democrats must stand for democracy. You think? So with that, I'm happy to welcome Judith Whitmer to the show. Judith is the chair of the Nevada Democratic Party. Judith, thank you so much for being here today. And I'm sorry you're going through this.
Thanks. Thanks. I really appreciate it, Nicole. And thanks to People for Democratic Party Reform, PDPR, for putting out the press release in support of the Nevada Dems. I really appreciate that and all the work that they do.
Well, it is a group. It's a group of people who got together, and they're just rightfully angry about this and said, you know, we got to do something. It's not just people from Nevada. It's people from all over the country who are coming together to say, what can we do? We need to get the word out.
Right, exactly. And I appreciate that. But I mean, this is a very complex situation for people that aren't party insiders or know how it all operates or how the structure works. But normally a coordinated campaign is established during the election cycle. So in an election year, there's a coordinated campaign that basically is responsible for supporting all Democratic candidates and for making sure that they have all the resources and tools they need to win their races. Mm-hmm. This is normally done through the state party. So recently, there's been experiments about working outside the party. If you know about the Virginia results, you know that they lost. They had huge losses in Virginia.
Right.
And that's a large part of that's attributed to the fact that they worked outside of the state party. They worked around the party because there's organizations like the DSCC and the DTRIP that they want control of everything. Well, my opinion is if top of the ticket elected officials do not want to work with a state party, that's their prerogative. I mean, they don't have to.
Right.
Then they operate as a PAC or an independent expenditure, not as a coordinated campaign where they're trying to take all the resources and funding from the state party and direct them all to the top of the ticket. Because quite frankly, the down ballot races are just as critical as the top of the ticket.
Right.
In fact, I argue that they're more critical because they have such an impact on the daily lives of Nevadans and, of course, across the country. Our schools are battlegrounds. School board races are incredibly important. Mm-hmm. Local city councils, county commission races, judicial races, all of those people have such an impact on our daily lives. And I would also argue that we can drive votes to the top of the ticket by inspiring people about their local candidates. People are much more likely to be inspired to go to the polls by down ballot races by local candidates that they know, especially in our rural counties. And we're not leaving our rural counties on the side of the road like has happened in the past. We're literally involved in a 17 county strategy across the state of Nevada with our county parties to identify and target different races within those rural communities to also make strides, because we want to keep all the extremists out of office. I mean, quite frankly, we can't afford to let a single Republican extremist win a seat in Nevada. And that's the work that we're doing. The rules, we're doing the work.
So what happened? There are certain resources that you get, the Democratic Party, state Democratic parties get from the national, from the DNC. What right. Those things, and a lot of people don't know the names, but there's like the van and the, you know, there are different databases and the money to, I guess, mine them to send out things that you're given by the DNC. Tell me when I'm wrong, because I don't know what I'm talking about here. But these are resources that you as a state party would have access to, and all of a sudden they were yanked from you and given to this other entity instead?
Yes. Yes. And even though we were following the rules and we were working closely with the DNC and working closely with all of our county parties and county chairs, we had a case where certain people that are used to having all the power and all the control decided they did not want to work with the state party once we were elected.
You were elected, that's because the progressive slate won, and many of your members in this progressive slate of candidates were members of Democratic Socialists of America?
Well,
some?
Yes. Yes, correct.
But is that the problem? They have a problem that you have progressives and some who identify as socialists? Are they buying the right-wing, boogeyman?
I don't think that's the problem here. I mean, I would say the majority of our board, the majority of our executive board are members of the Democratic Socialists of America. I don't really think that's a problem. Originally, they tried to label us all as socialists, and they couldn't possibly work with socialists.
Oh, God.
But once they realized that wasn't gaining any traction, then the whole thing turned to, oh, no, we can't trust them. We just can't trust them.
Why?
Even though we're playing by the rules and they're not, because they're not used to having to follow rules. They're used to having all the power, making all the decisions, and not having to work with anybody else. I mean, a lot of people have heard about the Reed machine. Mm-hmm. It's a legacy of the Reed machine. There's still these factions, and a lot of them are very, a lot of them are consulting companies that have made huge amounts of money off elections. They don't want to give that up. So this is all about money and power and control. It's not about ideology at all.
And the machine that they've built that they want to maintain control over. So now some upstarts, some radicals come into the action wanting to shake things up a bit, as we need in the Democratic Party. Part of my problem, look, I signed on to this in Florida. I became a precinct committee person. But frankly, the way the Florida Democratic Party is running, there's no place for me there. And I tried to go to like Zoom meetings, and I just felt like our voices were silenced. But it seems like in Nevada, they took it to the next level where they pulled funding and data and information from you that would hinder you, keep you from doing your job. So where do things stand now? Is there anything official going on? I know Jamie Harrison, the DNC, there's a petition going to him saying, what the hell, dude? I mean, obviously it doesn't say that. That's my what are we asking them to do? Like, do the right thing here?
Right. So PDPR is circulating petitions for signature to Chair Harrison. You can go to www.pdpr.org to sign one of those petitions. But basically they're calling on him for a fair and due process. There was a complaint letter sent to the DNC to Chair Harrison without any phone call or email or sending that complaint to the state party whatsoever. Like during this whole process, since I was elected in March, I haven't been able to get a return phone call from these same elected officials that have filed a complaint. I haven't been able to get an email response. We've tried to give them VAN access. And VAN is the tool that you use to access the voter file.
Right.
So each state party has ownership of their own state voter file. So our voter file belongs to the state party. It doesn't belong to anybody else. It belongs to the state party. We have a data sharing agreement with the DNC.
Okay.
So basically that agreement was violated because these same elected officials that haven't wanted to work with us, that have informed down ballot legislators not to work with us, have tried to make this whole case that they can't trust us, so they can't work with us, have now filed a complaint saying, oh, we need you to give us emergency VAN access, but we don't want it through the state party. We want you to give it to us through Washoe County Party, which is in Northern Nevada. And so they did. The DNC just simply gave it to them based on a false complaint without even talking to the state party in advance or trying to remedy any of these or come to a resolution. None of these people, we haven't been able to get any of these elected officials to the table with us. They won't even talk to us. But yet they've made this case that, oh, somehow can't trust us. We've been saying all along, hey, all we want to do is our job. We want to fulfill the responsibility that we were elected to do by the State Central Committee. And the State Central Committee is the governing body of the Nevada State Democratic Party. We won that election.
Right.
So let us do our jobs. Quit trying to take away all of our money. Quit trying to take away all of our funding. Quit trying to, you know, paint us as the bad guy of the blues because we're following the rules and you won't. Now, and it's simply about power and control.
The Nevada Democratic Party, if I recall, has had problems in the past. Wasn't there a big dust-up over a thrown chair that wasn't really thrown a few years back? I mean, there's stuff going on there. And I'll have you answer that. But the other question is, or comment, it's not like you're some, you know, radical outsider who came in. Before you were elected to chair the state party, you chaired the Clark County Democratic Party, which is Vegas. It's the biggest, you know, right? And so where is this coming from? I'm astounded. I'm not surprised, but I'm astounded.
No. Well, I will tell you that I'm astounded to a certain extent as well. Back in 2016, I moved to Nevada at the very, very end of 2015. And, became involved with the Bernie campaign as a volunteer and then as a delegate to the state convention. I was at that state convention when the supposed chair was thrown, but there were no chairs thrown. But it's that false narrative has continued to this day because one reporter got it wrong, who wasn't even there, but insisted that chairs were thrown. And that narrative has stuck with us since 2016. I mean, it's absolutely ludicrous that we're still being painted as being, you know, insightful or violent or anything else when that was totally not the case. But, you know, there's still this divide to this day of certain people that want to divide us up based on establishment versus progressive. And it's just not true. That's just not true anymore because the majority of Nevadans believe in progressive policies. Mm-hmm. The polling shows it, the data shows it, the research shows it. We stand with the majority of Nevadans. And that's one of the reasons we got elected to these positions is because the majority of our state central committee are progressives. But yet there's still this faction who's used to having all the power and all the control that once they lost those positions, they decided they were not going to work with us. Wow. This was decided right before the election because we have evidence showing that they started this whole process prior to our taking office. Because their internal polling was showing that we were going to win. So all these things were set into motion then to prevent us from doing our jobs because they wanted us to fail. They want us to fail so that they can either take back over or form a new party or burn it all to the ground. There's all these different machinations going on to achieve that purpose. And, you know, the reason it's disconcerting is because all along progressives have been told, oh, you just have to work hard. You have to engage. You have to participate in the process.
Right.
And then, you know, once you get to that level where you're fully participating, you know, we're all going to work together and make this an even better party. And I've come up through the ranks. I started on the board of a local county club, and then I got elected to the Clark County e-board and worked my way up to the Clark County chair and served two terms on the Clark County e-board. I mean, it's not like I just came out of nowhere. It's not like I haven't been doing the work.
Right. And Harry Reid's dead. Is there a person who's doing this? Like who we can point a finger at and ask, why are you doing this?
It's not just one person. It's a small faction of people. Mm-hmm. And the thing that's really sad is it really is a small faction. It's not the majority of Democratic voters. It's not the majority of Nevadans. It's a very small faction that are used to having all the control. And, you know, even with Senator Reid's passing, it's still evident that the same faction has decided that, you know, they're the heir apparent. So therefore, you know, they're going to keep the machine running. And it's a very successful machine to Senator Reid's credit. It's a very successful machine because it put together a huge fundraising mechanism. So they've got very deep pockets and they've got access to really big donors. And, you know, so that's how they keep going. That's how this keeps going. But, you know, that's not the tactic that we take because we do all of our fundraising as grassroots fundraising because we want to represent the people.
Sure.
And we've come in and said, we're not going to do things the same way they were done before. We're doing things that will bring people into the party. by opening the doors, by saying, hey, we want everyone to have a voice at the table. We want everyone to fully participate and engage. We're out there in the communities engaging on a daily basis. We're doing outreach continuously. We're not doing this as just a ramp up to an election. We're doing this with a purpose of serving Nevadans and representing Nevadans and bringing them into the process, because all those nonpartisans, we want them to realize that they don't have to register nonpartisan anymore because the party is paying attention.
We're right. We're not doing lip service anymore.
We're actually bringing them into the process, and we're delivering for their communities.
But now it seems like the party, the Democratic Party, the DNC, is undercutting you there as well, to the point where, you know, maybe they do need to register with no party affiliation because the Democratic Party is acting as if they don't want them. They don't want certain people. They claim to have a big tent, but then they pull nonsense like this. So again, I'm so disappointed. Jamie Harrison is not answering calls. Is he not weighing in on this at all?
No, I had one conversation with Chair Harrison, and I actually had three conversations with Senator Reid before his passing. And, you know, everybody says the same thing. Oh, we all need to work together. We all need to make sure that we win these elections, that we don't lose the governor's race or the senator's race.
But they're taking resources. They're taking resources from you and giving them to this other entity.
Exactly. And then they take resources away from us that we need to be successful, because everything again goes funneled to the top of the ticket, and then you're basically sacrificing down ballot races that are just as critical. But it's not even about that. It really is just about power and control. But again, when I meet with these people in the Democratic Party, the DNC, they all say the same thing. We've got to do community outreach. We've got to do more community engagement. We've got to be out there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But yet, you're taking away resources that we need to do that. So again, it starts to feel like you're being set up to fail when you're not getting support from your own, you know, from the DNC.
I hear that.
makes you feel like, okay, I'm doing everything I'm supposed to do, and I want to do more.
Okay, so what can we do? You mentioned the petitions at pdpr.org. There are a few petitions up there that we can all sign. What else? Can we call the DNC? Can we tell Jamie Harrison, the chair of the DNC, to do right by the Nevada Democratic Party and embrace the duly elected slate of leadership there and not undermine you guys?
I think all of that helps, yes. I think they need to know that we have that support. We have that base of support, that we are determined to prevail. We're not going to just turn away. We're not going to walk away. We're certainly not going to shirk any of our duties or responsibilities that we were elected to do. Mm-hmm. So yes, they need to make things right.
Okay. Well then, my listeners, I'm looking at the chat room now. You guys have your marching orders, and everybody else, pdpr.org. You can get the petitions there. I'll put a link on the blog at NicoleSandler.com where I post today's show. Maybe I'll get the address for the DNC so you can write to Jamie Harrison as well. I'm sure you tried everything before you decided to take this public. It's never attractive to take our, you know, inner squabbles out to the world, but sometimes you have no choice.
Absolutely. And I've done my best to like I said, keep everything above board, make sure that we're following the processes. I will not, you know, tear down anyone or criticize anyone, even though I've been attacked over and over again, even on a personal basis. I'm not going to do that. Mm-hmm. I believe solidly that it's incredibly important for us to reelect all of our Democratic elected officials. And that's what I'm trying to do, is to do the work that I was elected to do. And also, if anyone wants to support our efforts directly, then please feel free to go to www.nvdems.com/donate. And help us there as well as we work to fulfill a progressive agenda. Thank you.
You got it. Judith Whitmer, the chair of the Nevada State Democratic Party. And let me say that again. She is the chair of the Nevada State Democratic Party, but our National Democratic Party is acting as if she isn't, and some other group in the state that was not duly elected is. That's not democratic. So let's live up to our name, shall we? The Democratic Party needs to be democratic. Judah, thank you for the job you're doing, for the work you're trying to do. And you know what? God, this makes me so mad. This is everything that's wrong with politics that we want to fix, that apparently they want business as usual, and it's not going to fly. Judah, thank you.
Just remember, we keep fighting. We don't give up. When we fight together, we win together.
There you go. Judith Whitmer, thank you so much. It was great to talk to you. Hopefully, we can talk again when things are restored to the way they should be.
Thank you very much. All right.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye. How crazy is that? I mean, this just pisses me off. And you know, I get mad. It's part of today's cynicism. It's why I'm cynical again. Oh, my God. You know, I had my feelings about Jamie Harrison, but I bite my tongue because I don't want to be perceived as the person who's so critical of her own party. But on the other hand, this is what I do. And if I'm not going to speak out against what my party is doing wrong, then shame on me. So you know me, I'm always going to speak truth to power and tell them when they're fucking up. And hey, DNC, Jamie Harrison, you're fucking up. Do the right thing here. This is nonsense. You know, look, I thought I'm in the craziest state in the nation. And of course, we know that I am. So let me give you a quick, before our guest comes, we've got another guest today. We're going to talk to David S. Rudolph, who's the author of a new book called American Justice, Inside Stories from the Underbelly of the Criminal Justice System. And we were supposed to have criminal justice reform, remember? Yeah, that's out there in the ether along with the Build Back Better deal. Along with paid family leave, free college tuition, free pre-K. Don't get me started. But let me tell you what's happening here in Florida, where our governor, moron, death sentence, or I think I should now call him Death Satan. Death Satan. That's more like it. You know, he's been trying to push through this Surgeon General, and I'm not really clearing my throat. I'm, because it's hard to say the words. It's like I can't say Fox and the word that they follow when they try to identify themselves on that propaganda network. So it's hard to say. Surgeon General, I'm talking about Joseph Latipo, or as my husband calls him, Lapdog. So Lapdog was named by moron Death Satan a few months ago, but he hadn't been confirmed yet by the Florida State Senate because they weren't in session. Well, now they are. So today was the day. Joseph Latipo, the doctor who stood behind that crazy woman who held up the, I don't know if it was ivermectin, it was hydroxychloroquine, you know, the crazy woman who, I don't even remember what they called themselves, but he was one of them. He touted, you know, that he fought COVID at UCLA. Well, his colleagues at UCLA said, no, he didn't. He maybe was in a different department. He didn't work in the COVID wards with us. This guy is an anti-vaxxer. He's a denialist. And so a few months ago after Death Satan nominated him to be Florida's Surgeon General, he went around inside the legislature to meet some of the senators. And there's a state senator named Tina Pawlowski. Pawlowski? I think it's P-O-L-S-K-Y, if I remember correctly. Anyway, she it had just been diagnosed with breast cancer, and she was undergoing chemotherapy for breast cancer. And so Latipo gets to her office and walks in, and somebody in the office said, please put on a mask. He refused. Let me read to you from an article here. I got the wrong thing up. From the South Florida Sun Sentinel today. They published an editorial. Let me share it with you. It says, the headline of the editorial reads, Joseph Latipo and his contrived evasiveness must go. Dr. Joseph Latipo is an expert, all right. He's masterful at dodging questions, insulting the intelligence of Floridians, and avoiding straight talk about the need to be vaccinated against COVID-19. Florida's underqualified and overpaid public health officer faced a panel of senators Wednesday in the first of several steps in his expected confirmation as Surgeon General. For more than an hour, he danced around basic questions, proving once again that he is not qualified. In an opening statement that set the tone for his first confirmation hearing, he spoke of his training and research in cardiovascular disease. But he never even mentioned COVID-19 or the more than 64,000 Floridians who've died from it, perpetuating the reckless strategy of denial executed daily by his boss, Governor Moron Death Sentence. Are vaccines effective against COVID? Yes or no? Latipo was asked that question five times by Senate Democratic leader Lauren Book of Plantation. Five times he dodged, lest he give an answer that deviates from the party line, which his boss won't like. On Book's fourth try, Latipo said, quote, "The most commonly used vaccines in the United States." Oh, you know what? I have the video here. Hold on a second. I'm going to play it for you because truth in this case is stranger than fiction. Okay, so this is Latipo refusing to answer whether or not the vaccine is safe and effective. Okay, so hold on. Let me bring her up here. This is astounding. Again, on your screen, you'll see State Senator Lauren Book. She's the one asking the questions.
I believe that vaccines in fighting against a pandemic like COVID-19 are effective.
Do you believe? Okay, this is Latipo.
Thank you for your question, Senator. So, again, I would say that the question is a scientific one, and it's one that is answered with data.
Answer so, the question. Is it safe and effective?
The question is informed by data on, you know, on specific outcomes and specific therapies.
What?
So that's the scientific question.
Just a couple more follow-ups. Just a yes or no. Do vaccines work in fighting against COVID-19? Yes or no?
You recognize?
Okay. Yes. Okay. Senator, I as a scientist, you know, I am compelled to answer the scientific question.
Oh my God.
And I'd be happy to answer any specific scientific question that you
have
related to vaccines.
No, he won't.
Scientifically, do the vaccines work?
That's the third
against
time.
Preventing COVID-19. Yes or no?
Okay. Recognized.
Okay. Oh, thank you again, Senator.
Oh my goodness! This is torturous.
You know, yes or no questions are not that that easy to find in science. I understand. I think I have better clarity about your question at this point. So what I would say is that the most commonly used vaccines in the United States, which would be the Pfizer product and the product that was developed by Moderna, have been shown to have relatively high effectiveness for the prevention of hospitalization.
Okay, and it went like that. Are you kidding me? Then later on, he was asked about his visit to the state senator's office. Her name again, Tina Pulsky, I believe, who had just been diagnosed with breast cancer and was undergoing chemotherapy. They asked him to mask up, and Latipo said, "It is very important to respect individual preferences." What? He wouldn't give a straight answer about anything. And then finally, the Democratic senator said, "It's apparent we're not getting any answers here." And they got up and they left because it's Florida. This is what we've deteriorated into. This man who UCLA is denouncing said he may have worked here, but we don't remember him ever being in the COVID ward. We don't know who he, you know, worked with, but it wasn't us. This is who Ron DeSantis wants as the Surgeon General. And it's why people like me don't leave our homes. Okay. So now our guest is here, and I feel bad because he's been waiting while I got through this rant about Lapido. But it's another important topic, and it's one of the reasons why today I am cynical instead of just Nicole. I'm happy to welcome David S. Rudolph to the show. David, thank you for being here. David is the author of American Justice, Inside Stories from the Underbelly of the Criminal Justice System. The book just out yesterday. Congratulations.
Thank you. And I will answer your questions.
Thank you. You mean you're not going to like say a lot of words and the scientific answer? And I obviously don't know science, but I'll say a lot of words and use up my time.
Well, you know, lawyers generally say it depends. So, but no, I'll try to avoid that.
Now, you are a lawyer before you're an author. You have had a very distinguished legal career. And I got to say, there is a website. You have a website. It's your name, David S. Rudolph, RUDOLF.com. And you have like a timeline on there of, I guess, your involvement with the law. I found it really intriguing, and I'm wondering if you could just give us the basic timeline that you have on the website to explain what got you involved in the law in the aspect that you are involved.
Yeah, well, I guess it in part it goes back to my childhood, where when I was in fifth grade, my teacher took my sneakers out from under my desk because I hadn't put them away quickly enough. And she threw them in the wastebasket, and I promptly marched up to the wastebasket and told her she couldn't do that because it was my property.
Good for you. Yes, I love that.
And so that was my first pushing back against the abuse of power. And it sent me to the principal's office, and then my parents sent me to a psychologist to be tested to see what was wrong with me. And they just said that the psychologist said there really wasn't that much wrong with me. I just needed to understand what the limits were of certain people. So that's sort of where it started. During college, I was in college during Kent State and all of that upheaval in the early 70s, mm-hmm. late 60s, early 70s. I was in law school during Watergate.
Wow.
When the Attorney General of the United States was indicted and ultimately convicted for obstruction of justice, quite amazing.
So it can be done, huh?
Apparently, it can be done at some level.
Yep. Okay.
And then, of course, you know, I experienced Iran-Contra, and you know, all the things that made one question the ethics and the truthfulness of our government. And so it was a fairly natural progression for me to become a criminal defense lawyer and to sort of insert myself in between the individual and the government.
And it makes sense. So you see the sequence of events that was your lifetime that brought you to this place. And you've been, the bio says you spent your career defending the wrongfully accused and fighting the abuses of power that have resulted in these prosecutions. But sadly, the wrongfully accused continue to be accused, and the criminal justice reform we thought we were going to get with this administration hasn't materialized yet. Now, I know there are some inside forces that are keeping progress from happening, but the fact remains we have a criminal justice system that's wholly, I guess the technical term for it is FUBAR, and we need to fix it. And there were negotiations going on, right? Cory Booker and I think Tim Scott were working together, and then all of a sudden they just said, nope, we're done. Nothing's happening here. Is that the end of it?
Well, hopefully not. But, you know, these things come in fits and starts. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think we can give up hope. Hopefully they haven't given up. But things have not improved very much. I think the only thing that's improved has been the visibility mm-hmm. of the problems. You know, just like with police misconduct and violence and shootings, the incidence of that hasn't increased. What's increased is that they're now captured on video cameras and everybody sees what has happened. That never happened before. So it's similar in the wrongful conviction realm. We're seeing more of it as a result of DNA exonerations, as a result of law school clinics, innocence clinics, being started. Things haven't really improved, but they become more visible.
Okay, well, there's that. And there have been some changes. I mean, I think up until this year, last year now, we hadn't seen any convictions of police for wrongful shootings, and there were plenty of them, one after another, seemingly endless stream of police shooting, in many cases, unarmed young black men. And then Derek Chauvin was convicted of murder. And in fact, right now, the federal civil rights trial of the other three cops is going on. I'm surprised that we haven't heard more about it. Did America just, we got our fill that Derek Chauvin was convicted and now he pled guilty to violating George Floyd's civil rights, I guess, to avoid going through another trial. But these other three police officers are on trial and we're not hearing anything about it. Is that a problem of the media or is that our fault?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both, I guess, just to spread the blame around. But what happened, I was very hopeful. A lot of people were very hopeful, in the aftermath of the George Floyd tragedy, that maybe people were finally going to, be woken up to this and try to do something. And it seemed like that for a while. But I think that Black Lives Matter made a tactical error, in my judgment. I mean, okay, it's easy for me to talk. I'm a white guy,
right?
So, I don't mean to criticize people who have suffered for decades and millennial. But by going into this defund the police.
I always hated that slogan and I said it from day one and I'm as, left-leaning and progressive as they come. That's just a stupid slogan. And that comes from, this being a leaderless movement. Things go from the bottom up. Well, somebody needs to control the messaging. And that was just stupid messaging.
I think it was, I'll say it was unfortunate messaging.
I say stupid, but that's how I talk. So,
well, see, I'm a lawyer, so right. I say unfortunate.
Oh, right. And I'm a broadcaster, so I say stupid.
But, Nicole, they didn't really mean defund the police. What they meant was put the resources into other ways of keeping the peace in the neighborhood. That's all they meant. And if it had been, I hate to use
reallocate the funding.
If it had been marketed differently, I think the response would have been very different.
I agree.
But I think that is what happened. And I think the movement lost a lot of its momentum.
Yeah, I think you're right. Sadly.
And I don't know that it can get it back at this point.
Wow. And that's a shame because I'll tell you something. When I was looking at, maybe Cory Booker and Tim Scott are going to get something done. The main thing that I wanted to see fixed is this whole notion of qualified immunity. Really, police officers have immunity from, wrongfully killing somebody. And we see it all too often. And we see, I never say all. I think the majority of cops are probably good people, but too many of them. And I live down here in Florida, where I think many of them are hopped up on steroids. It's a mentality. And I get nervous if I run into a cop. I don't want to deal with them because the few encounters I've had have been with people who are angry and seem easily to fly off the handle. So I don't want to say the wrong thing. And I have a big mouth and I often speak before I think, which is not very smart. The fact that they have some kind of immunity, that they have free reign to do whatever they want to citizens is a word that I used in the last segment, undemocratic. Where did qualified immunity come from? What's this about?
Well, and it's not just qualified immunity for police, it's absolute immunity for prosecutors.
Wow.
Prosecutors have absolute immunity.
Really?
They could decide to indict you tomorrow because they don't like your podcast, and go ahead and have you arrested. You could be found not guilty because all the people like your podcast, and you couldn't sue that that prosecutor even if he admitted that's why he did it. He is absolutely wow. immune. And that's because the Supreme Court of the United States decided that prosecutors needed to not worry about what they did, the decisions they made, and therefore they needed absolute immunity. With the police, as you point out, it's a qualified immunity. It's a good faith immunity. So what you have to show in order to hold a police officer liable is that he did not act in good faith. He acted either intentionally, willfully, or best case scenario, if trying to hold them responsible, with reckless disregard for the constitutional rights of a particular citizen. Right. That's what you have to show. You know, negligence, gross negligence is not enough. Now, you know, having said that, you know, it seems to me that it's one thing to say, well, we can't hold them liable in terms of actual civil liability. But why is it, you know, when a plane crashes, the NTSB comes in and they do a root cause analysis. You know, they want to understand what happened, why it happened, and what can be done to try to prevent that from happening in the future. Every time a plane crashes, mm-hmm. every time.
Right.
Every time a police officer kills somebody or someone is wrongfully convicted and then exonerated after decades and decades, that is never done, ever, ever. And that, I think, is a fundamental flaw in our system. You know, we don't need necessarily to sue to get police to do the right thing, but why not just do an inquest, if you will, an inquiry that really delves into what's going on and maybe makes some positive suggestions of how we can, if not avoid it, at least minimize it going forward.
Sure. Well, that makes sense. You know, I brought up the things that some of the things that I think need reforming, but obviously you didn't write this book for me. You wrote it because you, in the course of your career, have had a number of cases where things went, as they were not supposed to. And you cite 8 different cases. What happened that made you say, all right, we need to fix this? What, if you can do it, and I don't know, we got 10 minutes left. Is there one thing or a few things that came to the front that you said, this is just not right? This needs to be changed?
Well, you know, over the course of my career, I obviously saw a lot of things that needed to be changed. But I think the defining moment really came during what's now known as the staircase trial, you know, the trial of Michael Peterson.
Right.
Where a blood spatter expert got on the stand and literally committed perjury. Michael was convicted because no one could prove he had committed perjury at that moment in time. But eventually, 8 years later, we were able to prove that he had committed perjury.
Wow.
The judge found that he committed perjury. The judge granted Michael a new trial. And that whole process and what I observed there really, it sort of devastated me at the time of the conviction. And I started doing a lot of wrongful conviction litigation at that point. And I really have, that's been my niche much more than criminal defense over the last, say, 15 years.
Uh-huh.
And so in doing those cases, I saw more and more of the problems. You know, I was able to go on a speaking tour after the Netflix documentary came out. I was able to speak to, you know, hundreds and thousands of people at a time. And so the book is really just an outgrowth of all of that.
Okay. If you, someone, you know, from the Biden administration called you and said, David S. Rudolph, you know, you wrote this book, American Injustice. You're talking about criminal justice reform. We're going to give you the ability to write the bill, to reform our criminal justice system. What would you change? What would you fix?
Well, there's a lot I would change, but, you know, I would start with screening of police recruits, you know,
please.
Mentioning earlier about the attitudes. I think, you know, a lot of police officers now are recruited from the armed forces and they come back from Iraq or Afghanistan. And there it's life and death, you know. And so when they're patrolling those cities or those communities, they're not there to be a friend to anybody. They're there to protect their own lives. And so they I think they sort of bring that attitude a little bit back home. Obviously, a number of them end up suffering from PTSD, which is not a good situation to be in when you're patrolling the streets of Detroit or Miami or wherever. So that would be one thing. Second of all, I would want to train these police officers on something that's called confirmation bias. I'd want them to understand that, you know, the first thing that comes into their mind about what a situation presents is not necessarily the thing that actually has occurred. And so, you know, we all suffer from confirmation bias. Mm-hmm. You know, doctors are trained not to fall into that. I think police officers and particularly police detectives and prosecutors and for that matter, judges need to be trained about that. And similarly, I think they need to be trained about implicit bias because we all suffer from that, whether you want to admit it or not. I admit it. I think everybody ought to admit it and just deal with it.
Definitely. You know, you mentioned implicit bias and I wonder about other attitudes and maybe misconceptions or misperceptions. I think it's better asked as a question. How much of a drag are TV courtroom dramas on real life? People expect that some forensic expert can come in and say, well, he did it because of this, this, and this. And they make it look so easy and you can wrap it up in 60 minutes, actually more like 48 because of commercials. And that's not real life, is it?
No, and a matter of, you know, it's interesting you say that because what really prompted me to allow the filmmakers to do the documentary and to sort of come behind the scenes with me was the fact that defense lawyers are portrayed in popular media as sort of sleazy, unethical.
Well, some, you know, some are.
There's prosecutors are as well, but
right,
they're never portrayed
right,
that way.
They're gotcha.
Always portrayed in the white hat. Mm-hmm. And so I just decided, you know, people need to understand what we do and why we do it, because the vast, vast majority of criminal defense lawyers, they're not in it for the money mm-hmm. or anything else, because we can make a lot more money doing personal injury cases.
Oh, yeah.
We're in it because we believe in what we're doing. And so I really wanted people to see that through the documentary. And I think that came through. You know, similarly, what happened with Deaver and how he was exposed, I think has really resonated with a lot of people who all of a sudden say, wow, I didn't realize that these experts can be that biased, that corrupt, if you will. Mm-hmm. I think that popular media has really skewed people's views, and hopefully all of the documentaries that are now coming out about the criminal justice system will help to correct that.
Right. And, you know, I should mention that you're no stranger to podcasting either. You have a podcast in which you talk about, real crime. This is a hot podcast topic. I deal with politics, so nobody wants to listen to what I do. But this is have you watched the Steve Martin short thing, Only Murders in the Building? Because that's what the premise of, that's what that's about. Just an aside, but try to lighten things a little bit. And you have a very popular podcast on the subject, yeah?
Absolutely, thankfully. It's called Abuse of Power, mm-hmm. and Audible has purchased it.
Nice.
And put a lot of resources behind it. We're in season two now. That's been released. We're in the process of recording season three. The stories are amazing. It's about the abuses of power. It's really the book and the podcast and my career have sort of all come together, if you will, at this moment in time. And so, I really hope that some of your listeners will listen to the podcast and read the book and think about what they can do to try to help the system get better.
Sure. The one thing that stuck out to me is that you deal with the issue of the question, how can you defend those people? I mean, I watched the Kyle Rittenhouse trial and I just... I'm sorry. I thought he was guilty. I thought he should have been prosecuted. He had no business being there. He shouldn't have crossed state lines, even if it was just a couple of miles away. I don't care. On so many reasons. And I wondered, I thought his attorney was sleazy, but that's my perception. And everybody is guaranteed a defense and someone's got to do it. What is the role of a good defense attorney and how can you defend those people?
Well, and you know, we get asked that question throughout our lives. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to give this sort of stock answer, everybody deserves a defense and blah, blah, blah. The truth of the matter is that what we do for the most part is try to put someone's conduct, what they've done in a very short, I mean, let's take Kyle Rittenhouse.
Okay.
You know, I don't know what his background was, but, you know, how much time did he spend going from wherever he went to where he ended up and shooting that person? You know, a few hours.
Mm-hmm.
So are we going to judge Kyle Rittenhouse by just those few hours? Suppose that before that, and I don't know anything about him, but suppose that before that, he was a great citizen who did great things for people. And now he sort of goes off the reservation, off the rails, for whatever reason.
Uh-huh.
So what we want to do as a criminal defense lawyer is we want to put that into context so that for the most part, you know, these cases are dealt with by plea bargains. You know, the trials are few and far between.
Right, right.
And so, you know, nobody asks a surgeon or an emergency room doctor, how can you sleep at night, you know, treating Kyle Rittenhouse if he's shot? But and that's because they're doing their job. They're doing what they're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
They're mitigating the damage that has been done to him. And that's really what we do. So I don't have any trouble sleeping at night because I view my role as helping the system understand what the motivations of my clients are, what situation they were in, the context in which they acted, and what justice really requires in terms of consequences.
It is not so black and white. The law, as I think medicine, you know, you learn things as you go along and you modify. I don't know. I'm neither a lawyer nor a doctor, nor do I play either on the radio, but the book is out. It's called American Injustice, Inside Stories from the Underbelly of the Criminal Justice System. And again, there's a Netflix, it was a like a mini documentary series, The Staircase, and now that's being made into a movie by HBO as well?
Exactly. The HBO is doing a docudrama, I guess they call it. Colin Firth is playing Michael Peterson.
Wow.
Parker Posey is playing one of the prosecutors.
Wow.
I mean, it's an all-star cast, and it'll be interesting to see how faithfully they followed the facts.
Are you involved at all as a consultant or anything?
No, they wanted to stay far away from me. I think they were afraid that any association with me would cause people to question the fairness of the portrayal. So I have made not a penny, nor have I profited in any way from the Netflix series or from anything else.
All right. Well, you'll watch it along with the rest of us, I guess. And we can listen to your podcast and read the book. David S. Rudolph, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to meet you, and I'm glad you wrote this. Thank you. It was. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Nicole. I appreciate being on.
All right. You take care. Bye-bye. It's a tough story. You know, Jack Rice, a dear friend of mine and of this show, is a criminal defense attorney in Minneapolis. He was our sort of our correspondent in Minnesota during the Chauvin trial. And I think during Rittenhouse as well. And, you know, Jack, I know one of those days he had to go to court for the sentencing of his client that was who did bad things. And it's his job. He defends people because, well, everyone is entitled to a defense. I don't know. Go figure. That's the one thing that works, right? That everyone is entitled to a defense. All right. With that, Ron Death's sentence is not. Don't defend him. He's wrong. He's killing people here in Florida. And as is Surgeon General. All right. With that, we're done. I'll see you tomorrow. I will leave you with the news. As always, thank you for listening, everyone. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Federal prosecutors are reviewing fake Electoral College certifications that falsely declared the former guy won several states in the 2020 election that he actually lost. The fake certificates falsely declaring Trump's victory were sent to the National Archives by his allies in the middle of December of 2020. They've attracted public scrutiny amid the House's January 6 investigation into the efforts by the Trump campaign to reverse his defeat. Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco said on Tuesday that the investigation is ongoing and the Justice Department will, quote, follow the facts and the law wherever they lead to address conduct of any kind and at any level that is part of an assault on our democracy. Okay, Ms. Monaco, we're going to hold you to that. President Biden, saying that a Russian invasion of Ukraine is imminent, warned that it would be the, quote, largest invasion since World War II and would, quote, change the world. Okay. But the picture being painted by each country is vastly different. State television in Moscow is depicting NATO forces as the aggressors, go figure, with tanks and troops heading to the Ukrainian border and snipers taking aim. NATO, meanwhile, says there is still a diplomatic way out of the crisis, but Russia must show that it's ready to engage in good faith in political talks. Good luck with that. The Kremlin denies that it's planning to invade and argues that NATO support for Ukraine, including increased weapons supplies and military training, constitutes a growing threat on Russia's western flank. Moving on to the COVID front. A New York appeals court judge on Tuesday temporarily restored the state's mask mandate one day after a lower court judge ruled that Governor Kathy Hochul needed approval from lawmakers in order to enforce a mask mandate. Appellate Division Justice Robert Miller granted the state's request to continue enforcing the policy while it appeals. Attorney General Letitia James said that her office would defend the mandate because, quote, we know that wearing a mask saves lives. Meanwhile, the Labor Department announced on Tuesday that the Biden administration is withdrawing its vaccine or test mandate for large companies. This following the Supreme Court's ruling blocking the policy. The administration conceding that the court has ruled that OSHA, the Labor Department's Occupational Safety and Health Administration, has no authority to oversee efforts to provide for the public safety. Just lovely. Meanwhile, a small bright spot on the horizon. Researchers at the Centers for Disease Control reported Tuesday that the Omicron variant causes less severe cases of COVID-19 among people needing hospitalization than previous strains. Those hospitalized after Omicron infections were admitted less frequently to intensive care, had shorter hospital stays overall than patients sickened by previous variants, and had shorter hospital stays overall than patients sickened by previous variants. Still, Omicron is so highly contagious that it has caused record numbers of infections, and the volume of the cases has pushed daily deaths to more than 2,200 on average, among the highest death tolls since early 2021. But Pfizer and BioNTech have begun a clinical trial for an Omicron-specific vaccine. The study will evaluate this new vaccine for safety, tolerability, and the level of immune response in up to 1,420 healthy adults between the ages of 18 and 55. Omicron cases currently account for more than 99% of new cases in the U.S. That's from the latest CDC estimates. COVID-19 cases are also spiking in places like Brazil, where officials in the big cities yesterday announced the postponement of their official carnival street parades due to the spread of COVID-19. And in the UK, police said Tuesday that they were investigating lockdown parties held at Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Downing Street official residence in what critics have said were violations of the government's own coronavirus restrictions. The allegations have left Johnson fighting calls for his resignation. Reports of large amounts of alcohol and jokes by staff about how to explain the partying to reporters have left Johnson's reputation badly tarnished. Was it ever good? And his ratings are now reportedly in a free fall. ITV reporting Monday that Johnson and his now wife, Carrie, went to a 30-person surprise party on his birthday in the cabinet room in June of 2020 when his government had banned indoor gatherings. Johnson's office said that he spent less than 10 minutes at the celebration and that he didn't believe he had broken any laws. Stay tuned. Meanwhile, despite her promises to the contrary, Nancy Pelosi announced that she's running for re-election again. The 81-year-old Speaker of the House has been in Congress since 1987. Nancy, it's time to go home. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is fully listener-supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.